Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about infectious disease, fact, fiction, and Ebola. Readers know that Ebola makes for a terrifying threat in novels. Whether the characters are endangered by it as a flesh-eating disease or the bad guys are plotting bioterrorism with it, most people are only familiar with the virus as a plot contrivance in a book. Once Ebola stepped off the page, though, and became a global concern, or panic, if you will, conflicting information and conflicting attitudes began to emerge. From internet memes to emergency response plans to polarizing opinions on how to handle the disease, the topic of Ebola is front and center in many places around the world. Tonight, we've invited an infectious disease specialist, an epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health, and the medical director of UMD's health services to talk about Ebola and other infectious diseases, fact, fiction, and fear. Let's meet our guests.
I'm Andrew Thompson, an infectious disease specialist at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth.
I am Ellen Hill. I'm the Northeast District Epidemiologist for the Minnesota Department of Health.
I'm David Worley, family physician and currently director of UMD's health service.
I have to ask to begin, is Ebola really a flesh-eating disease?
I would not call it a flesh-eating disease. It really causes an infection that's, at the beginning, influenza-like. People have high fevers, muscle pains, joint pains, and they develop vomiting and diarrhea. Later in the stage of illness, often they will have bleeding. Maybe that's where the flesh-eating fear comes from. It just sounds very scary. But at the end of their illness, they often will have bleeding, and it is fatal in many cases, at least the cases we've known about in Africa.
This came off the internet, obviously, and if it came off the internet, it must be true. Five viruses that are scarier than Ebola: rabies, HIV, the flu, mosquito-borne illnesses, and rotavirus. They're also more common, they're easier to get, so why isn't anybody freaking out about them?
I think novel illnesses are inherently scary. And to most of us, Ebola is a new illness. These other ones, we've lived with for some time. We know people who may have survived them, though it's pretty rare to survive rabies. To me, that's probably the scariest infection there is, because it's about 100% fatal. And how we define scary is important, because if we look at absolute numbers of fatality, every disease you mentioned worldwide has a higher fatality than Ebola. The flu can kill millions in a year globally.
It has in the past. I mean, some of our greatest pandemics back in 1917, 1918 with the Spanish flu were attributed to influenza. I should also, I would just comment that, you know, 5 years ago when H1N1 was a novel influenza virus, at that time, there was a fair amount of concern and some fear about the potential for that virus to kill, seemingly for folks that were not necessarily in the traditional risk for having complications with influenza. It was younger people. There was certainly some concern at that time about that virus.
If people could pretty much go any place and get a free Ebola shot, would that help to damp down a little bit of the hysteria?
You know, our experience at UMD in 2009 with H1N1 was that our vaccination rates were much higher than they traditionally had been. The problem at that point in time was the availability of the vaccine. It was difficult to get, and so we had limited supplies of it. Unfortunately, the standard sort of flu season vaccination rates are really poor, even among healthcare providers, which just, you know, shocks me to this point in time. Every year, I'm amazed that as few physicians, nurses, and other healthcare providers receive an annual influenza vaccine.
In terms of college-age students, it really depends on if they're living in the dorms or not. it's the congregate setting living that the college students are in is a huge factor. And for that matter, congregate living situations anywhere beyond even university campuses. In that respect, you could almost argue that it could spread a lot more rapidly on a college campus.
And you're mashed together in off-campus housing as well, where, you know, five or six people will share a house. And, you know, there's a lot of exposure in those settings as well.
Some of the populations that are at highest risk of influenza are the young and the very old. So we sometimes think of college-age students as being very healthy, and typically they are. They may get the flu and not end up in the hospital. So illness may be less severe in college-age students. However, they can still spread it. And that's one of the great benefits of the flu vaccine is it reduces the amount of transmission. And we don't want to spread it to our elders and young people in our community. And I think that's one of the benefits that people sometimes forget about.
There's a factor of the population that says, I am not going to get my child vaccinated. Let's talk about that a little bit and what some of the repercussions of that decision might be.
If you're not fully vaccinating your kids, you are putting other children at risk, especially children who cannot be vaccinated. For example, children who are battling cancers, various cancers that are compromising their own immune systems, whether the cancer is compromising the immune system or the treatment that the children are going through. And then there are just some children that can't be vaccinated, period, because they have an allergic reaction to a certain component of a vaccine. So it's really important to try and keep as high a vaccine coverage in the population as you can. The higher the vaccine coverage in the population, the more cocooned, if you will, the more people surrounding a child who cannot be vaccinated, it protects that child.
What about the folks that don't believe what the medical community is saying to them about vaccinations?
This is one of the great challenges that I encounter routinely. I think there are a number of factors. One is that vaccines may have been too effective. We've eliminated a number of illnesses from the community. So I don't know anybody who's died of measles, but it happens. It happens globally every year to tens of thousands of kids because they are not vaccinated. We have that here. We have the ability to prevent those deaths, and we've forgotten it because generations have passed. And so sometimes I talk to people about that, about the actual, you know, populations that don't have access to these vaccines and the morbidity, the brain damage and the actual deaths that occur when kids have these illnesses. There's also a concern that some harm may come to them from the vaccine. There are countless studies demonstrating that there's no harm from the vaccine and there's benefit. I don't know what the answer is to convincing people of the science behind it. That it's not a conspiracy, that drug companies aren't making billions off of selling vaccines. Vaccines, honestly, are not very profitable. That's why it's hard to get a new vaccine. That's why we don't have an Ebola vaccine right now, because we've known about Ebola for decades. But why would any drug company want to make a vaccine when they can't sell it to a rich country? Maybe we need better science education in our schools. I don't know what the answer is to convincing people of the science. Mumps, measles, they can be severe at any age. And, you know, typically they're not. And that's what people will say. You know, my dad had measles. He had mumps. I had chicken pox when I was a kid. And we're fine. But it's that 1 in 5,000 case, which becomes very severe and leads to brain damage, blindness, death. That's not that rare. If we have enough cases in our country, we will start to see very severe complications.
I would echo some of those sentiments. You know, when I was training in medical school, it was still very routine to see infants and toddlers with a form of meningitis due to Haemophilus influenza. At that time, the vaccine for that particular bacteria was being utilized and just sort of being more broadly administered to appropriate kids in the population, general population. It has been amazingly effective. Cases of Haemophilus influenza B meningitis are essentially non-existent at this point in time. I mean, they're rare due to the effectiveness of that vaccine. And I really think it is honestly a one-person-at-a-time conversation, a one-patient-at-a-time conversation. Many students that I see will say, I don't get the flu vaccine because I got it 1 year and I got sick. If they received the traditional flu vaccine, which is an injection, not the nasal, that virus is dead. There is no potential for them to get ill. If they got ill, it was because they had a concurrent infection with something else going on at the same time. But their perception is that that vaccine made them ill, so they'll avoid it, and they would rather take their chances, which is not logical in any way. So you have to have that conversation and sort of start with some of the very basics about where those misperceptions come from and hope that that's going to change their behavior in the future.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about infectious disease, fact, fiction, and Ebola. Our guests tonight, Andrew Thompson, an infectious disease specialist from St. Luke's, Ellen Hill, the Northeast Region District epidemiologist with the Minnesota State Health Department, and David Worley, the director of UMD Health Services. Moving back again to this issue of Ebola, as consumers, not as medical professionals, but as consumers, are we crowdsourcing things that should not be crowdsourced? Are we asking each other for opinions about things that we're not really qualified to come up with answers to when we should be talking with medical professionals?
Oh, that's a great question. In some cases, yes. You know, the internet has given us all an ability to speak to a broader audience. There's less of a hierarchy of information, which there used to be. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad. And sometimes, like you mentioned, junk science. It's easier for all kinds of information to spread. We still have credentials and agencies whose people whose job it is to really get to the bottom of the facts and, you know, recommendations based on science. In our culture, we're a little bit anti-authoritarian as well.
The expectation used to be that what the physician said was sort of the holy grail. Okay, I'll do that, doctor. And that pendulum has really shifted to patients being much more engaged and wanting to help direct their therapy or their choices for therapy or their treatments. And I think that's good, but I also think there then becomes a question of, you know, who is providing the information that is going to be considered to be accurate, relevant, based on science. And that's where a lot of this, you know, sort of evolves. The internet makes those sources of information so readily available, but whether it's truly good information is really debatable.
Most public health experts and physicians in my field, we're not supporting the initial New York and New Jersey quarantines. And I think there was a lot of pressure, maybe political, maybe some of this, you know, anybody can be an authority in public health in an emergency. But there was a lot of chatter that led to policy that was not necessarily sound or science-based. And that sort of backfired on some of the officials in those states, and they modified their policy. But I think in cases like that, the experts, the epidemiologists, the public health experts are the ones who day in and day out are thinking about these questions and trying to craft appropriate rational policy.
In public health, we do our best, especially as in the parallel discipline of medicine, we do our best to try and create evidence-based policies based on the best information that we have at this point in time. And the key thing with this Ebola that we've had to keep reminding ourselves of is that Ebola is not infectious until you're symptomatic. And so at that point, especially too, if you're dealing with a healthcare provider who is acutely aware of the symptoms of Ebola, has seen and been working with Ebola patients overseas or even here in the U.S., as we've seen, they are acutely aware of what symptoms we're looking for and at what point they are likely to be infectious to the rest of the community. But at the same time, we have to balance that too with what we're hearing from the general public and trying to craft those messages in such a way that we're trying to remain as transparent as we can and upfront as we can with the public, but at the same time acknowledging their fears about the disease. So when it comes to the policies that, for example, New York and New Jersey had put into place and other states are working on as well, it really depends a lot on how you're communicating. And unfortunately, sometimes public health hasn't always done the best job.
When it's a situation that draws as much public attention as this, do you feel that politics come in and kind of co-opt?
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
That nurse in Maine, well, first of all, she's a hero. I mean, she put herself at great risk and went and treated patients with a deadly disease. And I think people forget that. She came home and was actually treated fairly poorly upon her initial reentry, you know, put in a tent outside of a hospital in quarantine without exhibiting any symptoms. Maybe some of that was a political in motivation. I think some politicians have wanted to exhibit a very strong response to protect people. Honestly, I don't think they're necessarily trying to manipulate, but they want to protect the population. Politics does enter into it pretty easily, and the science can very easily get ignored.
My only comment on this is that I think policies need to be, and I think they are at this point, they're crafted and developed based on risk. Where there's no risk, there shouldn't be anything that is, you know, restrictive for that individual. This person probably had some degree of risk just based on her work and exposure, but it's balancing risk with rational policy that I think is most important. And some of the you know, steps that were taken in terms of quarantining her were probably irrational, particularly with the absence of no symptoms. So I think that's the struggle, is to acknowledge that risk can exist, to stratify it in terms of how much risk exists with that particular individual and their case, and knowing you have to know what that person has been through or exposed to or what their work has been to get an accurate sense of that, and then creating something in terms of a policy for following or monitoring that is logical and rational and is going to protect others who are at that point not really in danger or at very little risk.
Well, and of course that speaks to nuance and this culture in particular, where the media is involved and the way that we communicate with one another en masse has no concept of, no way of dealing with nuance at all. It's either this or it's that. That's a huge disservice to everyone, and yet this is what we as consumers have kind of bought and paid for. You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about infectious disease, fact, fiction, and Ebola. Our guests tonight, Andrew Thompson, an infectious disease specialist from St. Luke's, Ellen Hill, the Northeast Region District Epidemiologist with the Minnesota State Health Department, and David Worley, the Director of UMD Health Services. At the end of October, St. Louis County said that they have an emergency Ebola response plan. There are some possible people in the community, a very small number, but there are some possible people in the community that could possibly have a risk of bringing Ebola back from wherever. Let's talk about some of those people.
Well, I think there's certainly some concern regarding travel, you know, not just here at UMD, but anyone who is traveling to those areas. And, you know, the general guidelines at this point in time are that, you know, university-based travel or even personal travel is really not something that should be happening at this point in time. So I think there's certainly some risk. I think it depends on each individual case. And again, that's what happens when that individual gets off that plane in one of those areas. Who are they seeing? What circumstances are they in? Those are much more important factors than simply, I traveled there. So I think it really, you need to be able to get some solid information about that particular individual, and then again, put them into some sort of risk stratification. And my guess is that some of the, if there were instances, many of them would come back as being low or no risk. But I think it's important at least to think about. And I think St. Louis County is trying to do its part in working with the greater state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health, as almost all county public health entities are doing, to enhance communication, to be informed, to be educated, to be looking at their resources within the community, local hospitals, and to prepare if necessary, rather than react and not have that reaction be one that is guided with good information and safety.
Ellen, you mentioned something that I hadn't thought about. You said that you had had some conversations, some concerns expressed about people that Duluth is a port city.
That's correct. Duluth is a port city. We are, of course, connected to the North Atlantic via the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes system. And I'm sure many people have seen the ocean-going boats, for example, the Salties, that will anchor themselves out in the harbor. And frequently they're coming in either to deliver bulk cargo or to pick up cargo, for example, grain from the elevators in the harbor. And some folks have noticed that the international ports of registration are wide and varied and may even include countries, for example, like Liberia. But the important thing to remember with those ocean-going vessels is that the port of registry is really an economic decision on the part of the company. The crew that's on the vessels may not necessarily even be Liberian themselves. And who knows when they've last been home, even to their countries of origin. The other thing that's important to remember, too, is that the crew on the vessels, they can't leave the vessels without going through an impromptu customs screening session like we would normally go through at a border crossing, like, for example, up in near International Falls or Grand Portage. The ship would actually have to call a customs enforcement officer, to come down to the ship and greet the crew as they're coming through and checking passports and visas and all that, all the important necessarily official paperwork. So that's important to remember. And then if there is any Liberian crews on board, the key question is, how long has it been since you've been home? And plus, the voyage from West Africa to Duluth is a long time. And I've actually heard, I don't know the exact number of days, but I've heard it can be 3 weeks or more to get here to Duluth. So by that time, you're passing your 21-day quarantine period that folks are being monitored for. And of course, a lot of the shipping companies will have some arrangements in place too for healthcare and that kind of thing. And I don't know all the details about that. But those arrangements are usually in place to try and figure out if someone needs medical care in a port that the ship is in, how is that arranged?
Andrew, what about the medical workers? You made a point a little bit earlier that most of the people that have contracted Ebola are medical workers that have gone to these places to help.
That's right. In the United States, at least, most of the cases have been returned doctors and nurses who have been volunteering overseas, taking care of patients. And rationally, it makes sense that they contracted it because, as we've discussed, the people are not contagious until they're symptomatic. So if you're caring for someone who is symptomatic, who has vomiting, diarrhea, or bleeding, you're at risk of contracting the illness. So a number of workers have become ill in West Africa and been airlifted back to treatment centers here, mostly at Emory University and in Nebraska, where they have special biocontainment units which train for this sort of thing and exist for highly infectious diseases. Fortunately, with good supportive care, which we can provide here, really high-level intensive care, correcting people's electrolytes and giving them fluids. We've had a great, I shouldn't say great, but very impressive survival rate compared to the level of care that's provided in West Africa. So I actually think it's a real, the disease is really affected by that disparity. If we could provide high-level medical care in West Africa, the mortality would be far better than it currently is.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Andrew Thompson, infectious disease specialist at St. Luke's, Ellen Hill, the Northeast Region District Epidemiologist for the Minnesota Health Department, and David Worley, Director of UMD Health Services. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.